Members, let's get this hearing called to order. We have all kinds of people and some exciting things to discuss today. I don't think we have a quorum yet, so we will go on. Members will be hearing three bills today and an overview of the long-term care insurance. So we'll be taking action on the bills today. Remember that the bills are re-referred to the back to the possession of the Health and Human Services Reform Committee. So we'll send a memo to Chair Schumacher, who I think is in the audience today because he's got a bill, and give him with the description and the actions that we've taken in the committee, with the committee engrossment if the bill has been amended, just so you're aware of that. So with that, we are going to start with House File 345. Is Representative Zerwas? I haven't even seen him. Oh, there he is. I saw him this morning walking in, so I knew he was here. Welcome to the committee, Representative Zerwas. I'll move that House File 345 be re-referred to the Health and Human Services Reform Committee. Representative Zerwas, to your bill.
Well, good morning.
Good morning.
I'm on my second one, so we're,
doing good. Oh, wow.
we're talking about House File 345. Palliative care. And so palliative care is about treating symptoms of a serious disease at any stage to improve the quality of life. There's often a misconception when we talk about palliative care that it's synonymous with end of life or hospice care. Palliative care includes care at the end of life, but should also be a part of all curative treatment plans for all serious and chronic diseases to treat symptoms and improve patient quality of life. Sometimes it gets kind of wrapped in with a discussion around physician-assisted suicide. This is not anywhere near approaching that discussion or that topic. It's about a holistic team coming together to allow someone to live. We've seen a broad coalition come together in support of providing improving access to palliative care, and we should focus our energy on improving access and making this more mainstream. And so the bill would create a working group to try to get this integrated throughout our healthcare continuum. Madam Chair, members, we have three testifiers here today, and I think in interest of the committee's business, if we could probably move to testimony.
That would be great. Do you have, is it Ellie Beaver?
I'm looking at the site.
Okay. And do you want them all to come up at the same time? Or?
Sure, we can make room.
Okay. Eric Anderson and then Pam Fontham. Let's take a break while everybody's getting organized. And we have a quorum. Representative Lohmer moves to approve the minutes of February 1st. Any additions, corrections, or changes? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails, and the minutes are approved. With that, welcome to the committee. And Ms. Beaver, would you identify yourself for the record?
Sure. I'm Ellie Beaver. I'm the Government Relations Director here in Minnesota for the American Cancer Society Cancer Action Network.
Welcome. You go ahead.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Keel and members of the committee. And I'd like to thank Representative Zerwas for carrying this bill and Chair Keel for hearing it in her committee. Sorry. As you know, the American Cancer Society has spent years raising awareness of cancer and raising funds for research into treatment and prevention, and we've been extremely successful. Cancer deaths have declined 25% since the early 1990s, thanks in part to advances in treatment and increased awareness of some of the causes of cancer and how to reduce cancer risk. But cancer still causes immeasurable pain and suffering. Every day, 82 Minnesotans are diagnosed with cancer, and 27 will die of their disease. We recognize that treatment for cancer is more than just ridding patients of the disease. It involves making sure the whole patient is considered when surviving cancer. Nearly two-thirds of people who are diagnosed with cancer are surviving more than 5 years, and there are nearly 15 million cancer survivors in the United States. That's why improving palliative care is a priority for us. Many more Minnesotans who are diagnosed with cancer are either surviving their diagnosis or living long past it. We need to ensure that those survivors have the highest quality of life possible. Palliative care addresses the symptoms of treatment and disease so survivors can continue to do the things they need to do, such as work and take care of their family, and things that they love and that make life worth living, like playing with their kids or grandkids, dancing at a loved one's wedding, going on a family vacation, or continuing a beloved hobby. Palliative care not only addresses symptoms like pain and nausea, but it can include physical therapy to regain mobility, massage to reduce the swelling from lymphedema, and support to families reeling from the cancer diagnosis of a loved one. While palliative care is essential to high-quality cancer patients aren't the only ones who can benefit from palliative care. It's for anyone diagnosed with a serious or chronic illness. It's appropriate at any age and any stage of illness, and can be provided alongside curative treatment. Establishing a committee that can evaluate the palliative care system in Minnesota and make policy recommendations to the legislature on how to improve it will help all patients with serious or chronic conditions and their families get the care and support that they need. I'd like to turn it over to Dr. Anderson, if that's okay, a palliative medicine physician with Allina Health.
Thank you. Welcome, Dr. Anderson.
Please
identify yourself for the record.
Churchill and committee members, my name is Dr. Eric Anderson, a palliative medicine physician at United. I'm a medical director of a long-term care facility and the lead researcher for a four-year study of late-life supportive care at Allina Health. And I'm here today to speak in support of House File 345. Palliative care has a very special place in the medical world. It is specialized medical care for serious illness delivered by a team of trained medical and non-medical care providers. In its generalist form, it's part of the work of every primary care provider, every surgeon, every oncologist, indeed all doctors and providers who care for patients with serious illness. Palliative care is appropriate at any stage of an illness, and it can be provided along with curative treatment. In my work at United, good palliative care often helps patients to tolerate their cancer therapy better. The goal is always to improve quality of life by treating the whole person as well as the disease. An example of the benefits of palliative care comes from some work recently done at Allina Health. We trained a team member in basic palliative care approach using national guidelines. They saw patients at home and explored physical, emotional, spiritual, and cultural issues. They asked what mattered most and communicated that to the rest of the healthcare team. The patients who received this fairly simple, early form of palliative care spent less time in the hospital, maintained their sense of well-being better, and they made informed choices about their care. Choices that ended up saving over $900 per patient every single month. Good palliative care has been repeatedly shown to provide care that's more satisfying to patients and at lower cost. Most studies show that patients actually survive longer with good palliative care. It is, without any doubt in my mind, an essential part managing the wave of aging Minnesotans that will need compassionate, effective care for serious illness. Palliative care in Minnesota is being held back by limited access to programs and hospitals, particularly outside the metro. We also have a major shortage of staff trained to provide it. We know from a successful rural palliative care initiative that communities can rise to the occasion given the opportunity. House File 345 creates the advisory committee that can help lawmakers identify these gaps and promote solutions that will bring palliative care to more Minnesotans. Thank you for your time, and I'll turn it over to Pam.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Would you please identify yourself for the record?
Yes. Dear Chair and members of the committee, my name is Pam Fontem. I'm a Red Wing resident, a nurse, and a volunteer with the American Cancer Society Cancer Action Network. I am here to speak in favor of House File 345. My experience with palliative care is both professional and personal. When my dad was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer, I was devastated. I knew the terrible pain patients face with pancreatic cancer. Thankfully, my dad was offered palliative care from the very beginning. Palliative care helped my dad create a roadmap. When things got tough, I did not have to make the decisions. He had already made all of them. Palliative care also allowed us to care for him at home. He had no hospitalizations and only one emergency room visit. Palliative care allowed him to do the things that he loved, which included mowing his daughter's lawn just 5 days before he died. We did not transition to hospice care until just a few days before his passing. Palliative care allowed my dad to fight cancer with dignity and not pain, and allowed me to be a daughter rather than a nurse. Now consider the story of my Aunt Lois, who fought cancer for years. There was a lot of talk about radiation, chemotherapy, physical therapy, but never of palliative care. The family was never told that she would not beat her cancer. And then one Friday, seemingly out of the blue, the family was told to come immediately to the hospital. My Aunt Lois was in the ICU. The family felt all alone and completely unsure of what was happening. Weeks later, after being in the ICU for weeks, she was transferred to a rehab facility. The family assumed their mom would get better and come home. When I saw her, I saw pain. She hugged me and whispered, "Please tell them." Lois, who had never wanted to disappoint her children, had had enough. Sadly, instead of being a niece, I had to be a nurse. I had to start the difficult conversations that palliative care would have started. I had to tell her five kids that her mom was not going to beat cancer. 5 days later, she died. The family was not prepared. If palliative care had been offered, they could have had a different story. Their mom may not have beat cancer, but the process would have been much less shocking and painful. My stories touch upon the value of palliative care near the end of life, but it's critical to remember that palliative care is a benefit to patients at any stage of a life-altering illness. The rough road ahead is so much better with a map. With the stories of my dad and aunt in mind, I hope that you will all support House File 345. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Members, do we have any questions of the testifiers? Representative Pence.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and probably Representative Zerwas. My experience of having been a board member at Quiet Oaks Hospice House, and my husband is a current board member, I know that sometimes the hospice house will do palliative care if they have the room, and a lot of times it's for a week while a family goes on vacation or something like that. So with the task force that you're proposing here, would it include all avenues of where palliative care could take place, or is it mostly looking at medical facilities?
Representative Zerwas.
Madam Chair, Representative, that's a great question. The palliative care task force would look at how to better integrate this, beginning from medical school education all the way through, to get this to be more of an ingratiated, ingrained in the minds of providers. As the doctor stated earlier, every physician within the healthcare continuum can provide palliative care and provide that depth of knowledge and treatment. And so this would be, you know, in an ideal setting, it would be available really from diagnosis through natural death in a multitude of settings, in a multitude of scenarios.
Representative Tyson.
I just want to say thank you very much for bringing this forward, because having had the experience with the hospice house, I know hospice and palliative care is something that is kind of this great secret that not many folks know about until it's either too late or, well, pretty much it's too late. They don't have time to plan. So I really thank you and say this is great work. I'm glad that we're finally getting ahead on this game and doing some great things. So thank you all.
Any other members that would have any questions? Representative Freiberg? Did you? Okay. I'm sorry. I thought I saw you wave your hand. Yes, and I would say, I won't bore you with my stories, but I've seen both. I've lived both. And I would say that I have a sister-in-law that passed over 20 years ago, and her daughter is still struggling with it. And I remember when we went to see her, they were like, Mom's going to get better. And my husband and I looked at each other and went, no, she's not. She's on her end stages. So, and it's so much nicer for family to have that guidance and that direction and those conversations, because it gives your loved one, it just helps things along much better. So I thank you, Representative Zerwas, too, for bringing this forward.
Madam Chair, just in brief and closing, as Ms. Beaver and the testifiers have said, this is really not about end-of-life care. This is about the continuum of care and quality of life for patients. It was 1995 when I was 15 years old, and I'd been on the heart transplant waiting list for 2 years. And the previous 6 months, I had been in the basement of Station 10's intensive care unit waiting for a heart. And because of my blood type, and my antibody profile, because of the 7 previous open heart surgeries at that time, my immune system was hyperactivated, my antibody level was high, and they cross-matched me, they tested me for 17 different donor hearts, and my body had rejected all of them. And so we waited and waited and waited. We tried chemotherapy to lower my immune system, to try to put in a heart that didn't match, and I lost 30 pounds, and I couldn't get out of bed. And it was at that point they said, you know, this doesn't make sense. You're not going to get a heart. You don't need to be in the hospital. A 15-year-old boy doesn't belong in the hospital for the last year of his life. Go home. Be with your family. We can provide care at home. We can get you down on an outpatient basis. I went to class 2 hours a day. Now, I picked study hall in English. Those were two classes you didn't do much in, but, but I got through to school and be with my friends. And it was a few months later that my miracle came along with the experimental heart surgery that we ended up having instead of a heart transplant. But palliative care let me live. When everyone else in the world was saying that I was dying, palliative care let me live. So that's why it's important.
What a wonderful success story. That's, yeah, very encouraging. Is there anyone in the audience that would like to testify? Okay. Well, thank you very much for, and I guess I went and made a motion before we had a quorum, so I have to go back and do the motion so we can actually pass this. So I move that House File 345 be referred to the Health and Human Services Committee, and we've heard it. And with that, I'll renew the motion, and all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay. The motion prevails, and House File 345 is referred to Health and Human Services Policy. And I thank you all for coming and testifying. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Where are we at? Representative Schumacher, are you here? I think so. There we go. While he's coming to the testifying table, I'll move that House File 582 be referred to Health and Human Services Reform Committee. We have the bill before us, I believe, and I understand that A1 amendment is an author's amendment. I'll move the A1 amendment. Representative Schumacher, to your amendment.
Yes, this amendment gets the bill into the form in which I would like to discuss it. And I'd ask for your support.
Okay. Any discussion to the amendment? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? No? Okay. Motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Okay. Representative Schumacher, to your bill is amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. The House File 582 in front of us is working on enhancing some language that was originally passed in 2001 when we were trying to regulate some of the pool agencies that were operating in the state. And as all of us know, that in the last 16 years, the world of healthcare, particularly for hospitals and nursing homes, have changed with their workforce and some of the things that are involved with that. And with that change come definition changes and some of the issues that go with there. The industries have changed. The pool staff business has changed as well. And so we've had a few issues with the way those definitions have changed, the way the industry has changed, and this is just bringing everything up to what we would like to see to make it work. With me today to talk a little bit about just what those issues are and how this bill will fix that is Kimber Rahlstad. Now, Kimber came all the way from Grand Marais last night to visit with us today and to tell us what tell us about the bill and what we can do here. She's the administrator from North Shore Health, and we welcome her and are really excited to hear about all the great things that this bill does.
Thank you. Welcome to our committee, and thanks for making the trek down. I greeted her earlier and told her that she's farther away than I am. Would you please identify yourself for the committee?
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. I am Kimber Rahlstad. I'm the administrator of North Shore Health. And as we were speaking earlier this morning, Representative Schumacher said, you need to tell them what that is, which is we are the hospital, we are the nursing home, we are the home health agency, and we are the ambulance for Cook County, Minnesota. So we have a little bit of interest in what goes on in healthcare, and we take care of the people that live and visit, and we have a lot of visitors to the Great North Shore of Minnesota. As I said, I'm Kimber Rahlstad. I'm the administrator of North Shore Hospital in Grand Marais, and I'm here today to speak in favor of House File 582. This legislation is simple, but it's important, particularly for rural hospitals that are very dependent on the services of physicians and advanced practice providers that use healthcare professional staffing agencies. We're often known as locum tenens organizations. This legislation removes five words, quote, and other licensed health professionals, unquote, that were added to the Minnesota Statute 144A70 by the 2015 legislature at the request of the Minnesota Department of Health. The underlying law has been in place since 2001, registering staffing agencies that provide nurses, nursing assistants, nursing aides, and orderlies. With the addition of the five words, the department is now expanding that section of the law to regulate the process of obtaining healthcare professionals, including physicians and advanced practice providers. The department was not clear about its intention to extend regulation to physicians and advanced practice providers, nor did they share what problems they were trying to address by adding those five words. Now, this regulatory creep may not seem like a big deal, but for Grand Marais and other rural providers, failure to remove these five words will significantly change our ability to staff our emergency departments. The current process used by the emergency department and physician staffing agencies does not meet the requirement in 144A70. In the model used by these staffing companies throughout the country, these providers are almost always independent contractors and not employees. As I said, I'm the administrator of a very small, very rural, very remote hospital. Grand Marais is 80 miles from the next closest hospital. The legislative change made in 2015 will have a significant impact on our ability to obtain emergency department physicians and will likely result in a sizable increase in costs for these services. And that is if we're able to get companies to continue to do business in Minnesota. According to the emergency department staffing company we use, they may leave the Minnesota market unless the language of this current law is changed. And they have indicated to us that if they do stay in Minnesota, the rates will increase 25 to 30%. For Grand Marais, that would be an annual increase in expenses of $250,000 to $300,000. Now, North Shore Health is a district hospital, and in 2015, we had an operating loss of $701,000. An increased cost would be $250,000 to $300,000 would not be able to be absorbed, and we would likely have a tax increase for our community. But even more important than the increase in cost is the potential inability to obtain providers, which would impact our ability to keep our emergency department open. That would impact the people who would depend on us for care. This new regulatory burden could impact every hospital that uses temporary providers and emergency department staffing agencies, essentially every hospital in Minnesota. It disproportionately impacts rural hospitals who utilize these staffing agencies to provide the providers and advanced practice providers and physicians in our emergency departments. It will also impact temporary coverage for anesthesia, surgeons, and many other providers. If House File 582 is passed into law, hospitals in Minnesota will continue to use companies, as we do now, to provide staffing for critical areas such as the emergency department and surgery, and not experience an astronomical cost increase. Even with eliminating the five words, the Department of Health will still continue their oversight of the nurse staffing agencies who provide temporary nurses, nursing assistants, nursing aides, and orderlies to hospitals, nursing homes, and home care agencies, as has been the case since 2001. I thank you for your consideration, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Members, do you have any questions of our testifier?
She came all the way from Grand Marais.
I know. My first question is, how many hours does that take?
Madam Chair, last evening it took six.
Not bad. I acknowledge that I'm seeing that in my hospital too, the challenges of just getting people to be able to serve an emergency room or extra, the extensive things, and our nursing home is hiring a lot of outside people that come in for a few months, and it really helps us to be providing of services. I'm guessing that's absolutely necessary in Grand Marais, probably especially in the summertime. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, we utilize temporary staffing agencies on the hospital side, and particularly for physicians, not as much in the nursing home at this point, which we prefer not to if we don't have to.
That's good. That's good to hear, because there's a challenge. So do your numbers go up quite a bit in the summer, or is it pretty stable?
Madam Chair, yes, they go up, particularly in the emergency department, significantly. We can quadruple at times our days of patients seen in the emergency department.
All those vacationers, right?
Yes.
It's a beautiful area, so I'm sure there are a lot of people that come up there. Well, with that, is there anyone else that would like to testify to the bill? Well, Representative Schumacher, do you have any final comments?
No, just please vote for this.
Okay. I'll renew my motion. Man, a few words. I'll renew my motion, House File 582, as amended, to be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Reform. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Okay. Motion prevails, and House File 582 is amended. As amended, is referred. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
While Representative Keel is getting everything ready, I move that House File 262 be re-referred to the Health and Human Services Reform Committee, and we have the bill before us. Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. Members, I've in the past carried some Alzheimer's bills and dementia bills, and am really glad to see us doing some things, education and research. But we're kind of coming back to talk about, do we have enough chairs? I'm sorry. Coming back to talk about the issues that are at hand. I'll let them talk about all the details, but I saw a quote I wanted to read to you. It came from Sandra Day O'Connor, and it kind of addresses what's going on. Our government is ignoring what is likely to become the single greatest threat to the health of Americans. Alzheimer's disease and its illness is 100% incurable and 100% fatal. It attacks rich and poor, white collar and blue, men and women without regard to party. A degenerative disease, it steadily robs its victims of memory, judgment, and dignity, leaves them unable to care for themselves, and destroys their brain and their identity, often depleting their caregivers and families, both emotionally and financially. And, you know, I want to add that taking care of somebody with dementia is a very rewarding job, but a very exhausting job. And it breaks your heart at times, and it makes you smile and laugh at others. I had the privilege of taking care of my grandmother, which I got very close to, long before she had Alzheimer's or dementia. But I would say that I got to know her even more personally when I took care of her. I became her little sister, not her granddaughter. She would often ask me where I was, but we had a great time together. I found out that I shouldn't drive over 30 miles an hour because our father had told us not to. But you know, I could revert that right away. We were going to the farm, and I said, oh, well, we're going to feed people in the field. Well, that's what she did for my grandfather. So we were okay with that because we moved on. So it isn't always heartbreaking, but it is a tough job, and many, many more of our citizens are going to be taking care of that. And I think we need to address more of it, and so this bill requests that we expand or extend the working group that we have had in the past. So with that, I will turn this over to... I totally forgot about the amendment.
I know.
And you're going, what the heck?
So I understand that the A17-0037 is an author's amendment, and I will move the A17-0037 amendment. Representative Keel, to your amendment.
Thank you very much. Well, with that, I will move on and let the testifiers present. Please.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Beth McMullen, and I'm Vice President of Government Affairs for the Alzheimer's Association. The amendment that is here before you is adjusting just some of the language on how the working group, who is appointed to the working group, and then also just ensuring that that diversity and inclusion is a part of this working group. We want to ensure that all Minnesotans are represented on this working group. So that's what the amendment is.
Okay. Any discussion to the amendment? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Representative Keel, your bill is amended.
Thank you very much, members. As I had spoke earlier, I just really think this is an important thing that we need to keep addressing. The university, Mayo, all of those areas are looking at research, but we need to keep looking at our ability to address the challenges of dementia and Alzheimer's. And with that, I'm going to let our testifiers speak.
Madam Chair, again, Beth McMullen with the Alzheimer's Association. Thank you for the opportunity to speak in support of House File 262, and thank you, Representative Keel, for introducing this bill. This bill essentially will reconvene the Alzheimer's Disease Working Group to review and revise the recommendations that were made in 2011 to help Minnesota deal with this disease. Alzheimer's is a progressive brain disorder that damages and eventually destroys brain cells, leading to a loss of memory, thinking, and other brain functions. And as Representative Keel said, Alzheimer's is fatal. Over 5 million Americans are living with Alzheimer's, including an estimated 91,000 in Minnesota over the age of 65. By 2025, that number is expected to increase to 120,000 people in our state. There are nearly a quarter of a million unpaid caregivers in Minnesota for people living with disease, with this disease. And in 2015, our Medicaid costs in Minnesota alone were $767 million. And that is estimated to skyrocket to over $1 billion by 2025. Alzheimer's is currently the sixth leading cause of death in Minnesota and the only one in the top 10 with no means to prevent, to cure, or to even slow the progression of the disease. While researchers continue to explore treatments and cures in an attempt to find a medical response to this disease, it's critical that we manage the impacts of it on our families, our communities, and our budgets. In 2009, the legislature created the Alzheimer's Disease Working Group, and in 2011, that group made a set of recommendations, including 20 legislative recommendations. These original recommendations fell into several categories, including early detection and diagnosis, quality of care, cost savings, training, education, research, and public awareness. Act on Alzheimer's might be a familiar phrase or name that you know, and that is one of the key success from the Alzheimer's Disease Working Group. And it has become a national model for community engagement, healthcare practice change, and health equity inclusion. However, many of these legislative actions that were recommended need to be updated to ensure that our state has a strong plan going forward to address this disease as a public health crisis and to minimize the budgetary impacts. Minnesota was one of the first states in the nation to create what we call a state plan for Alzheimer's. That's what these recommendations really were. And we'd like to update that plan to address changes in policy from our own healthcare reform that we've done here in Minnesota and the progress that we've made around health policy, as well as what's happening at the national level with federal policy changes. A lot has changed in the last 6 years. So by asking this working group to review and revise the 2011 recommendations, essentially conducting a needs assessment for our state and our communities, we hope to identify a clear set of next steps needed for policy and program changes to address the future increases of Minnesotans living with this disease, as well as the devastating impacts on our families, communities, and our state. So we thank the Minnesota Legislature for its steadfast support of Alzheimer's issues, and we look forward to continued commitment. I ask you to support the motion today, and we have a couple of advocates here who'd like to share their stories and the impact of this disease on their family.
Thank you, Ms. McMullen. Do we want to move right to Linda Collins?
Come on over here, Linda.
Madam Chair, my name is Linda Combe, and this is a very personal disease for me. My mother died of Alzheimer's disease, and I want to thank you for allowing me to be here to talk about the disease. My mom suffered from Alzheimer's disease for about 5.5 years before she passed away in 2013 at the age of 76. She is one of 12 children from Little Fork, Minnesota, up by International Falls. And of those 12 children, 7 have been diagnosed or have died of Alzheimer's. 2 are still in memory care at this time. So I live with the fact that I am surrounded by this disease, both by my mother and by my aunts and uncles. I was the main caregiver for my mother, and we were able to keep her in her home for the first 5 years with help from others, but then it became too difficult and we had to move her into a memory care facility. My role as a daughter changed, and I know you had talked about that too. I became the mom, which was very difficult. It was the reverse of what I knew. Such a loss for me made me realize that I actually lost my mom earlier than her death. And that is something, as an Alzheimer, I guess, relative survivor, that's something that you always deal with, is that you lose that loved one much earlier than the death. Our family struggled in many ways during her disease, and it was difficult for me to find the right resources. By coming here, I hope that by reconvening this working group, and that we will find ways to help deal with this disease. First, I'm hoping that we can find a way to have early detection and diagnosis. With my mom, we went to many doctors before we finally figured out that that was what we were dealing with. Second, I want to try to see if this group can ensure training for direct care workers. We used, you know, many times when she was in the home and also at home because we had to bring people in. I just had to hope that the people that were taking care of her were knowledgeable and loving, and, you know, we just need more education for care workers. Also, it's so important to take care of the caregivers, because that's something that I struggled with and tried to cope with during that time, because I didn't really always know where to go for that. Long-term care financing is another thing, is that the minute that you find out that you have Alzheimer's or your family member has, you have to start planning. And I never got any help with that, and it took a big loss on our family, you know, just the financial portion of it. And I think, lastly, I'm hoping that just the public awareness of this disease is that, you know, there's very few people that I know that haven't been touched either personally or know someone that has been touched by Alzheimer's. It is growing. As Beth said, we have over 91,000 people over 65 that have it in Minnesota right now. There is no cure, and there's no slowing down of this disease. So I'm hoping that with the realization and public awareness, we can push for ways for research and just helping with the people that that have the disease. So for this reason, I urge that you will support House File 262, and I want to thank you for letting me be here. And if there's any questions, I'm here.
Are there any questions? Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Combs. Next on the list, I have Mr. Eric Lynn. If you could state your name for the record, please.
Madam Chair, my name is Eric Lynn. I'm the oldest son of five boys in our family. Our mother, Irene Lynn, suffers from Alzheimer's and its crippling effects. I'm here to testify in support of House File 262. Thank you for your time today. Our story's been nothing short of a nightmare. The bill before you today will help families like ours dealing with this disease. Irene is the mother of five sons, four daughter-in-laws, and seven grandchildren. Irene was a caregiver herself, working as a nurse's aide for over 20 years, oftentimes taking us boys to visit the residents she cared for, some of which became like grandparents to us. Today, our mother Irene resides in a memory care unit in the same facility she worked in all those years. Alzheimer's was a devastating blow. We had no idea at the time just how devastating it would be or the challenges that lied ahead. As young boys, we lost our father, Ron, to a farm accident at the age of 42. Somehow our mother persevered through it all, never putting her own pain or well-being first. Mom raised us, kept our small farm going, and worked full-time, never missing school events or activities. After diagnosis in 2009, at the age of 58, she soon lost her job, her privilege to drive, her home, her dog, and her livelihood. We became caregivers, not sure who to turn to, searching for answers, often in denial ourselves. Alzheimer's is very complicated, and challenges can be very overwhelming. It seems every time the disease reared its head, we were kicked down the road. Mom is currently in her third care facility. Our family is at her side daily to help with meals, bathing, one-on-ones, common needs that even the facility struggles to provide adequately. As a young family, it has been very difficult, to say the least. So many unknowns in search of answers, looking for direction to make the best decisions possible. As soon as you think you have things figured out, you're on track, the wheels fall off, and it all falls apart. For families that are just being diagnosed today or have a loved one living with Alzheimer's already, they are in search of help and need of direction, oftentimes living in crisis mode, not knowing who they can trust or what they should do next, praying for a cure. Early detection, public awareness will help families prepare early for many of the challenges that lie ahead, doctoring, financial, personal, family. Medical professionals must diagnose and direct families for professional help as soon as possible in order to help plan and prepare. Identifying caregivers and offering support, education, a day off will benefit all involved. We have professionals, caregivers from docs to PCAs that do not understand the stages of this disease and its progression. They cannot assure families that they are competent to advise or care for our loved ones or families. A kick-the-can solution to a hopeless fight compounding the suffering. My mom is still Irene, Lynn. Irene is still a mother to Eric, Steve, Phil, Sam, Mike. Irene is still a grandmother to Spencer, Callie, Hayden, Hudson, Kale, Briella, and Aaron. This is my mom. She is just as important as all your mothers, and this is all we have left. Please help us fight this disease. For these reasons, I urge you to support House File 262.
Thank you, Mr. Lynn. Are there any questions? If not, thank you very much. Mm-hmm. And finally, we have, and you're going to have to help me.
That's okay.
Miss Erin
Truax.
Truax?
Yes.
Truax?
Truax.
Okay,
Truax. It looks fancy. It's not.
Well, thank you for being here today, and if you want to restate your name again.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Erin Truax. I am the granddaughter of a great man who lost his life to Alzheimer's in 2014. Thank you for allowing me to talk about my family's experience with the disease and how this bill before you today will help families like mine deal with Alzheimer's. I'm here to support House File 262. My grandfather was officially diagnosed with Alzheimer's in 2009, even though he had been exhibiting symptoms for many years before that. When he was diagnosed at a stage 4, which is more mid-level, going towards the advanced stages of Alzheimer's. The diagnosis, even though we expected it, it was very difficult on my family, but mostly it was hard on my grandmother, who was his primary caregiver. She passed away unexpectedly in 2012 from a massive heart attack. He had come home from adult daycare that he went to a couple times a week, and he found my grandmother lying on the floor. He tried his best to resuscitate her, but was unable to, and it caused a slew of confusion for him. And with Alzheimer's being cruel, you have problems with short-term memory, so he had to basically relive that moment in the days to follow until he understood more so what was going on. We believe that the stress from my grandfather's illness led to her early demise. She was only 73 years old. She didn't have the caregiver support she needed. Family support was always there, but when it came to navigating our complicated healthcare system and access to reliable information regarding Alzheimer's, the system had failed her, and it was very stressful. She didn't know what to expect, kind of taking it day by day. After her death, my grandfather went to live at an assisted living facility that specialized in memory care. He was later kicked out of that facility because he exhibited normal symptoms of Alzheimer's. In this particular case, it was anger. He had issues with a certain other resident there, and anger is a common side effect of Alzheimer's. Before he passed away in 2014, he lived in 4 different facilities. He was picked out of some of these care facilities for being aggressive, as we talked about before, but also wandering. And all of these things are common to people living with Alzheimer's. I believe that a facility that specializes in memory care should be trained how to deal with the common side effects of Alzheimer's instead of removing them or having the family remove them from the facility or doing the take them to the hospital and let the hospital coordinators deal with placing him in a new place. There needs to be better training and regulation across the industry. The bill before you today will help address direct care worker training, caregiver support, and so much more. And for these reasons, I urge you to support House File 262. Thank you, and I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you, Ms. Truax. Yes. Are there any questions? Is there anyone in the audience? Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Wilmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't really have any questions. I just want to thank all of the testifiers who came and told your story. They're very moving and heartbreaking, and it's very exciting to know that we're going to continue this work group and see what we can do to help folks. I have similar stories in my family, so I can really relate to what's going on in your families. The mother-in-law who passed away, father-in-law, and now my own mom is going through similarly to yours. So thank you so much for being here and sharing your stories with us.
Thank you, Representative Wilmer. Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just had a friend that brought his father home to their house from a facility, a nursing home. It was $8,000 a month. They had the luxury of being able to have an apartment in their basement, of their house, rather, and his mother is living there. And now they brought his father home, and he's a young 70-something, I know, in his 60s, with Alzheimer's. But fortunately, they have the caregivers. Both Kevin and his wife will be caregivers, as will the mother. So financially for them, it's going to be a benefit and a help. It's going to be a hardship, of course. It's a lot of work as caregivers. But financially for the family, for the mother, for the children, the grandchildren, and for the father who has Alzheimer's, it is better to be at home, although a hardship financially and also just mentally and physically. But what is being done with home community-based care, according to the studies from 2011, have we come up, has that group given to the legislature a pretty good plan in place already that really deals with community home-based care and that helps the caregivers that are loved ones, the children, the parents, or anyone else that is caregiving at home? Or does this new group that will be formed because of your bill, Representative Keel, have to address that?
Representative Keel.
Yes, Madam Chair and Representative McDonald, I believe that it's as you're hearing from the testifiers even, there is a real mixed direction in memory care. We are looking at ways to help, whether you choose to keep family at home, if that works, or even in the memory care. And I actually have an aunt right now I'm taking care of. And she's been quite sick lately, so we're doing back and forth hospital and nursing home. And what I've learned is that not everybody in the care unit all knows her, and they know what to do with her. But we went to the hospital, and they didn't. And they're very good nurses, and they deal with things. But the realization of how to deal with somebody in memory care. A prime example, she needed her face washed. She doesn't see well. She does not like to be touched quickly. You have to let her know you're coming at her. And the nurse, God bless her, was washing her face. And she said, as she's putting the washcloth on her face, "Carolyn, I'm going to wash your face." Well, she jumped and struck because something came at her, and she didn't know what. And she couldn't comprehend what was said to her. At the same time, the washcloth was going to hit her face. And I stopped the nurse, and I said, "You have to prepare her for what you're going to do before you do it." But that was a realization. This just happened a few weeks ago, that not everybody understands exactly what has to happen in a loved one's life. And family knows best because they know them as a person. But there is that understanding that I don't think we have continuum, and we're hearing that from the conversations that not everybody understands, and so that's something that this work group hopefully will identify, and we need to educate our nursing staff as well as help with families to do community at-home assistance and just guidance. Sometimes, folks, just knowing how to do something for somebody is so important. It's a basic action. I'd never really even thought about it, but I was reading, have been researching Alzheimer's a little more. And when we're at home and somebody has the basics of starting of dementia, they won't take a shower or a bath. Why? They usually do that. But they can't because they can't figure out how to either undress, remember how to undress, or to turn the bathtub, the water on. And those things are so difficult, and yet they might do all kinds of things that are fine. They seem very normal. So those are identifiers, but we need to do more research and try and look at and see what we can help with. And I got a feeling Ms. McMullen wants to respond to.
Ms. McMullen.
Madam Chair, Representative McDonald. In the original recommendations, there was one section, and I will send a link to this report. This is the report recommendations that was given to the legislature. Number six, and that was pursue cost-saving policies, and included in there were a few recommendations around home-based services. So I think that that definitely is an area that needs to be reviewed and ensure that we're doing all that we can to support people, to keep people in their homes if that is where they choose to live. This is about patient-centered care, ensuring that people have the type of care in the space that they hope for. So that should be definitely part of our discussion.
Thank you, Ms. Mullen. Representative McMullen?
Madam Chair, yeah, follow up. Ms. McMullen, thank you. In regards to the material you passed out, the 249,000 Alzheimer's caregivers in Minnesota are providing 284 million hours uncompensated care, is that the home care? Is that the family members that are caring?
That is, Madam Chair, Representative McDonald, that is care both that they're providing in their home, or it could be support care that they're providing even when somebody lives in a facility. So, Eric and his family are still supporting their mother, and they spend quite a bit of time, assisting and being a part of her care plan. So that's all that money.
Madam Chair and Ms. McMullen, could I add this?
Mr. Lynn?
I'm putting 32 hours a week in the care facility. My mom is just my time. So 32 hours a week, and then the other families, we're logging about 60 hours a week because of the complexity of it and my mom's mobility and short staffing. So that's 60 hours a week on top of upwards of $5,000 a month for her care. Plus, we buy all the support that she needs, diapers, wet wipes, all the things that she needs because of that licensed assisted living that she's in. So can you imagine how much that compounds to our lifestyle? I mean, to be there myself 32 hours a week. So, my business is on hold at this point, but I want to be there at the end of this journey. I know that every hour counts, but just to give you an idea of the time I've spent in the facility. So, thank you,
Mr. Lynn. Mr. Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just one last comment. We too went through this with my father. Well, it wasn't Alzheimer's, but a hospice and at home, but another topic. And it should be, of course, family members. We need to take care of our loved ones first. Sometimes families don't have that luxury or financial stability to do so. How many of the uncompensated care, according to the your material, $3.5 billion, the value, are family members that could have maybe qualified for the personal care assistant associate, the PCAs? Are there any that are family members that are taking care of their loved ones that could qualify for a PCA that have not?
Ms. McMullen?
Madam Chair, Representative McDonald, I don't know the answer to that. So I'll see if I can find some numbers and some information on that for you.
Yeah, and then lastly, thank you, Madam Chair, Ms. McMullen. And the reason I asked that is the first question that I asked my friends Kevin and Sarah was, and their mother, have you signed up to be a PCA, the personal care attendant, I think it's called, which will allow them to keep their father at home. Of course, they save the state money and their own money, and it's all better for the family. So that was actually the first question to them. So I would imagine that in the 2011 study that was a question posed and perhaps an answer was given. But if not, certainly encourage the next group to look into that. And I know that you good people that are on top of that far better than me here.
Ms. McMullen, any comments?
Madam Chair, no, we will certainly look into that and I'll see what information I can find for you.
Okay, thank you. Representative Baker.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and wonderful stories today, Chair Keel. Thanks for bringing these forward. Especially, Eric, your story of your mom and five boys, oh my gosh. My mom had four boys, and Dad was saved with one more girl at the end. So I can imagine there's not much furniture left when those ages were going on, and knowing that your father passed at such a young age, and your story, and again, I feel your pain because your mom is a superhero to you.
Yes.
And you need to make sure that you're there for her during this time. And it hurts to hear these kind of stories, but we need to hear them. So thank you guys all for taking the time to come down here. To you, of the author, I guess, Representative Keel, this was going on before, and then it stopped. The task force, the working group, and it's kind of getting resurrected again, which is a great idea. Is there not a sunset to this group? Is it going to continue on? And I'm just kind of curious about the long-term plan. I see some four-year moments in here, but I'm just curious of the plan of the length of this working group. So if you could answer that, that'd be great.
Chair Keel? Madam Chair and Representative Baker, it is every four-year review. So as we hopefully, that would be wonderful if in 4 years we had some kind of answers, you know, just to even slow the disease down or know why it's being caused, why we're getting it. And at such a young age, I had even heard somebody in their 30s, which frightens a lot of us because, you know, how do we know who it is or is there choices we're making that we need to change? And I often wonder that because I, too, like the early testifier, she mentioned, my whole family has my dad's entire family in it, and I'm watching now my father has vascular dementia. And we haven't really talked about it a whole lot, but I'm watching it come. And as I research all the information, I see all the key things that are coming forward. So we need more research, yes, I would believe that this is going to be longer than 4 years, but I would hope that university and Mayo and all the researchers are able to come up with something that explains how we're dealing with this. And, of course, we're living much longer. And so we can live much longer with this disease also because we know how to help somebody survive much longer. So, it makes it very challenging.
Ms. McMullen?
Madam Chair, Representative, our intention with the reconvening the working group and having it meet every 4 years is to ensure that plan is just continually ensure that we're on the right track and that we're adjusting for any changes in policy and so forth. I don't think that it needs to be necessarily an ongoing, continual process, but just that check back in. You know, every couple of years just ensure that our plan is on track and that we're adjusting. So that is our hope for this working group.
Thank you.
And again, Madam Chair, just to follow up, I know that in Wilmer we recently received a grant for the Memory Cafe, and that has been a terrific support group for a lot of folks. And again, we've got some great champions out in west central Minnesota that's working on this. And you know, Representative Keel has been our champion here with this disease, and thank you for carrying that torch for us here. But I think even the working group is should stay there and keep focusing on what are the other support systems that we need for family members to do what you're doing. If we can't find that cure sooner than later, we will find it someday, I hope. But if not, we got to make sure the families can still stay together and not go broke. And also just emotionally hang in there because these support groups are important as well. So, again, thank you for bringing this forward.
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Chair Keel, for bringing this forward. As most folks in the room have been touched by this in some way or another, so I appreciate it. And specifically to the bill and the working group, I guess it's more of a comment, and even to the bill we heard prior, coming out with a set of recommendations, I hope, you know, because we do care about this and there's been a lot of folks that understand how this affects our families and our communities, and what I hope as a legislative body that we really take these recommendations seriously. Specifically to your point, I think you made a really good point, Representative McDonald. Like, this really talks about such as home care work and a lot of different ways that we have conversations around in the legislature, and I think we should take those recommendations really seriously when they come back and talk about budgets that reflect the values that we're talking about here today and remember this when it comes time to putting together some of those things around funding and around moving things forward, because I think oftentimes we get excited about working groups and things, but when it comes to making the hard decisions around the recommendations, that's when we fall short. And so I hope we can be reminded of your stories, and I hope you come back and tell these stories again and again when we need to really make tough decisions around funding some of these things. So thank you.
Thank you. Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify? Okay. I just want to make a quick comment. One of the things I hope that we also include is some education for the family on what some of the symptoms are and how they deal with them. When my husband's father was struggling with emphysema, he had memory loss. And his Greg's mom used to get so mad because he would ask repeated questions, the same question over and over again. And what I learned from being a part of a group that was, I was on a nursing home board, was that you always answer the question like it's the first time because they don't know. And some of those things are really helpful to find out. And also, I hope we also look at the value of music and what that does to a person, too. So with that, any final comments quickly, Chair Keel?
No, thank you very much. I just vote for the bill.
Okay, so I renew my motion that House File 262, as amended, be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Resource Services Reform. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails, and House File 262, as amended, is re-referred. Okay, so while we're waiting for Chair Keel to come back, members, today we will be hearing a presentation on long-term care insurance. So if the presenters could make their way up here, which they are.
Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you very much for having us here. My name is Robin Rowan. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Insurance and Financial Services Council, or MFSI. MFSI members provide financial and retirement security to Minnesotans through the sale of life insurance, annuities, long-term care insurance, and retirement plans. MFSI members support over 50,000 jobs in Minnesota, and our agents and financial advisors work with consumers in every corner of the state. When Fred and I are sitting at a table like this, we're generally opposed to each other. So this is fun for me. But on the topic of long-term care insurance, we're completely on the same page. We are in full agreement that there needs to be a healthy and viable long-term care insurance market, and that has to be a piece of a healthy long-term care financing system. And in fact, our talking points were actually so similar that we decided to present jointly. So Fred will provide an overview, and I will add the industry perspective. For football fans, think of me as Troy Aikman to his Joe Buck, if you will. So long-term care insurance has gone through some really significant growing pains, but the industry and regulators feel as if it has turned a corner. There's still a lot of work that needs to be done. Right now, 45% of long-term care costs are covered by public programs and only 3% through private insurance. And I think you've heard from the folks that were here before that family caregivers end up picking a huge percentage of that difference up. But what's really important, I think, is that regulators in the industry and public policymakers all across the country are having these conversations, and we really feel that these conversations are going to lead to the growth of a very stable market with a wide variety of affordable long-term care products, which is what we need.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Fred Anderson. I'm the Acting Deputy Commissioner and Chief Life Actuary for Minnesota Department of Commerce. So obviously we regulate Robin's companies. but no, I agree we're on the same page on this issue. So we had a handout. I assume everybody has it.
Yes.
So we'll start going through that. I just wanted to first talk about the overall goal. The goal that we have some control over is to expand insurance coverage with the kind of sub-goals of helping people and their families and their long-term care needs, related to their actual long-term care needs and the related finances, and to help reduce the Medicaid expenditures on long-term care. And then in the next slide, I'm not going to go over it, but one thing I wanted to highlight are two things. First of all, I think there needs to be a private-public coordination of ideas related to this issue. The private market will help a lot, but it's not going to solve everything. So I think there needs to be engagement on the public side and the private side. And related to the private market, one of the key takeaways, and we'll get into this, is there needs to be a variety of different insurance products to handle different life situations. So everybody's needs are different, so it's not like a one-size-fits-all solution on the insurance product side will fix everything. People's incomes are different. The amount of money they have set aside is different. Their family situation is different. Some people have a large group of family members able to provide that initial care, and some seniors are kind of isolated without those resources immediately available. So depending on all those factors and other factors, there needs to be a variety of insurance products available. And we'll get into how, you know, what we do here can help the situation, what the, some of the constraints are and how we can fix those. So getting into just some background on the situation right now, obviously, you know, the baby boomers are aging, and so this situation that we're in right now, it's only going to expand as far as the needs of everybody, whether it's the elders or family members. So the average age of a person needing long-term care is 78. And from an insurance perspective, the need for long-term care is defined as an inability to perform at least two activities of daily living. And examples of those are bathing, dressing, feeding, going to the restroom. So that's one category. The second category is a severe cognitive issue, like we've been hearing stories about earlier in this meeting. What's key is that this care is not covered by Medicare or other health insurance. And that's why there's this need for a different type of insurance called long-term care insurance that generally covers nursing home care, memory care, home health care, assisted living care. So that's not covered by anything else. So that's it's why there's a need. Currently, and you know, I'm a son, I'm a grandson, so I provide some of this care, but statistically, a lot of this initial care is provided by daughters. So daughters are feeling the brunt not only of the heartbreaking situation and the financial situation directly related to the care, but also time away from the career, time away from their spouse, time away from their kids, time away from activities. So obviously, you know, as we've heard, it creates a lot of stress emotionally and financially. When these conditions become more severe, such that, you know, it gets beyond the ability of a family member to take care of all the needs, it becomes even more costly. So there is care out there in the form of home health care, assisted living care, and nursing home care. And that care can cost in excess of $150 a day or $50,000 a year. So obviously, it's, you know, there's the emotional and stressful side, but there's also the financial side. And, you know, and that's one of the roles of insurance is to cover those costs. Unfortunately, at the current time, only 10% of those that are 65 and over have long-term care insurance. So for the 90% of us, including me, that are without insurance, I'm not over 65, by the way, but if I was, you know. So those without insurance, it's basically its reliance on family care and savings until it's depleted. And so for people without insurance, after the savings is gone and there's a continued need for care, the cost for that care generally gets passed on to Medicaid. And with the baby boomers aging and with, you know, Medicaid's primary purpose to provide health care for the poor, this is kind of a secondary purpose, but the cost of this care for long-term care needs is skyrocketing, and it's basically expanding Medicaid costs at an unsustainable pace. So if there are no changes, if the status quo continues, we're basically going to end up with bankrupt households and bankrupt governments. And so that's why, as bad as the issue is now, it's only going to get worse as the baby boomers age. Can we keep going?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I got something.
Okay.
So I think you've heard the very real personal side of what happens when family has to step up and take care of loved ones. But there's some really sort of staggering statistics about what can happen caregivers that missed work to care for a loved one went from 64% in 2010 to over 77% in 2015. And that's a really, obviously, significant number. In addition, caregivers lose an average of 33% per year in wages, and they miss an average of 7 hours of work per week. And if that's a 40-hour week, that's about 18%. So that, again, is incredibly significant. Private insurance can step up to that challenge. In 2014, there were 7.2 million people that held long-term care insurance policies. The value of those policies, if they used 100% of their benefits, would be $800 billion. And in 2014, long-term care expenditures were roughly $225 billion. So there's a lot of room for insurance to pick up a lot of this financing. But the challenge has been the affordability of the products. And we've made a lot of strides, but that continues to be a challenge. And we'll talk more about some ways to resolve that.
Thanks. So if we go to slide 9, we're just going to step back and explain at a high level how long-term care insurance works. So the average age of a person who purchases long-term care insurance is between about 55 and 60. The average premium for a typical policy is around $200 a month. It's sold with the expectation that that premium will not change. But on just about every contract on page 1, it provides the right for the company to request from the regulators a rate increase if factors go differently than expected. The average age of the first claim is between 75 and 80. So there's a 20-year period where the company is collecting premiums and investing them in order to provide the benefits down the road. There are a range of benefits. They cover home health care, assisted living, and nursing home care. The daily benefits range generally from $100 to $200. It can go a little bit lower, a little bit higher. And there's generally an inflation provision where, because the cost of care tends to increase over time at an inflation rate, there's often inflation protection in the policy, so those daily benefits will increase generally to estimate the cost of the care inflation. There's also a distinction. There's some policies have lifetime benefits, some policies have limited benefits. So for some policies, your first, say, 3 years of care are paid for, and after that, the insurance does not cover the policy anymore. And I'll get into, I think this will become more clear as we talk about the past and present situation with long-term care insurance. So going to the next slide, from 1990 through about 2005, it was kind of the golden age of long-term care insurance. There were affordable products that covered all the long-term care costs. A lot of them had very high inflation protection and covered your benefits for the rest of your life. The pricing for these products was based on expectations of life expectancy, lapses of the policies, the length of claims, and investment returns. And I think one of the points brought up a little while ago about the fact that more people are living to the age where they attain Alzheimer's and are living longer with Alzheimer's, that's kind of a major factor that wasn't really considered in the pricing of the products back in the 1990s. So during that time, there were increasing sales, and insurance became a significant source of long-term care funding for many Americans. At that point, you know, this was starting to be observed in the early 2000s. Several factors reversed this trend. Life expectancy increased over what was expected, you know, when the products were priced. So more people reached age 78 than expected, and that was one of the drivers of, you know, more people reached the age where they would go on long-term care claim, and that was driving up the cost. Fewer people were lapsing the policies, so, you know, at some point if you decide you don't want the insurance anymore or can't afford it, there's an expectation that some people would just drop the policies, but I think so many people saw the value in these policies that, you know, it's pretty rare that people drop the policies these days. As I mentioned before, the claims are now longer in general, mainly due to Alzheimer's and people living with Alzheimer's for a longer period of time. and there were also lower investment returns than expected. So that 20-year period between when you start the policy and you're collecting premiums and when the claims are being paid, you know, the companies were assuming they would be able to earn 6 or 7%, and instead they were earning, you know, lucky to earn 4%. So that was the past, and the present situation really started at about 10 years ago. So on existing policies, you know, there continues to be a serious situation where companies are able to justify rate increases on the current policies. So some people have been paying the same premium for 10 or 15 years, and then all of a sudden it's like we need a 40% rate increase. You know, and that's significant, and it's caused a lot of problems, and I'll get into that in a little bit. New policies are now costlier than they were in the past. There are fewer policies that offer lifetime benefits and inflation protection. And with these losses and the lower sales generated due to the higher costs, most of the companies got out of the market. Robin will speak to the reasons for that a little bit.
Yeah, so in 2000, there were 125 insurance companies that sold long-term care insurance, but by 2002, there was only 104, which is a 17% decrease, and currently there are about 10 that are actively selling policies. So there's been a really significant contraction of the market. And in a recent survey, companies that have left the market pretty much cited what Fred said, which is that, you know, poor product performance and concerns about managing this really big risk in an uncertain regulatory environment were the two biggest reasons that they gave for leaving the market. And just to sort of understand how challenging this product has been to write, I mean, think you buy it, they said if you buy it when you're 50 and don't use it till you're 80, that's 30-year time period. Before you're using it. And so, I mean, think of what things were like 30 years ago. I mean, I looked exactly the same, but things were very different. So 30 years ago, we didn't know about the impact of Alzheimer's. There really wasn't assisted living the way it is now. And if you think about how the product itself worked, the product is guaranteed renewable. So that means as long as the consumer pays, the company honors the claims. In addition to that, premiums aren't guaranteed, but they're supposed to be level funded. Regardless of age, and costs certainly were not level funded. So if anything that went wrong, interest rates, poor investment performance, changes in morbidity and mortality, all those threatened the viability of the product.
Ms. Roman. I think Representative McDonald has a question. I just was wondering if you would like.
Oh, well, thank you, Madam Chair. I didn't mean to interrupt, but before I turned 50 last year, I spoke to my insurance friend in Delano and looked at my life insurance policy. And I think a good portion of those are in their 40s and 50s have a good life insurance policy. I certainly want to take care of my family when I get hit by a truck or something. But anyway, in looking at long-term care, because we wanted to talk about long-term care, and I thought, oh, I'm way too young to buy that stuff, for Pete's sake, and I hope to live a long time. But he did share with me the product of life insurance that you can use your life insurance when, if you do need long-term care, it can tap into that, and then the payout, of course, would be less subtracted of that of long-term care. So, but I wasn't aware of the product, and Luke, my insurance guy, said many people weren't aware of that product and that offering. So, what can the state do to continue to educate, and/or is it even the state's position or department? To educate people about those products, as you speak about, that, okay, you certainly have life insurance, but now you can also have term insurance, long-term care insurance with that.
Ms. Roman.
Madam Chair, Representative McDonald, yes, hybrid products are one of the bright spots that I referred to earlier, and not just long-term care. Carriers offer them, the general life insurance companies offer them, and there are two ways that they work, the two different variations of it. One is that you can pay for the policy in a single premium and then sort of spend down the life insurance benefit, which is what you refer to. And then if you should die before using the entire benefit, there's a death benefit that's left. And that appeals to people often because with long-term care insurance, there is sort of a use it or lose it factor. Companies are starting to change that, but that's currently how long-term care works. So those life insurance policies have a lot of appeal. You can also buy a long-term care insurance rider to go onto your life insurance policy. The issue with those products, again, are cost. They tend to be, they can be relatively expensive, but they are a great option for people. And I think with respect to how we can let people know, I think this is a great opportunity for public-private partnership. And, I mean, that's something, I see Lorraine in the audience, but that's something that groups like Own Your Future do a really good job with in letting people know what options are out there to cover their long-term care. We certainly, as the industry, try to do what we can to let people know, but I think there's, you know, it helps when, you know, the government can step in and also say these are, you know, good, valid options and you need to think about them sooner rather than later.
Okay. Thank you. Yeah. Mr. Anderson?
Right. Madam Chair and Representative, I think you make a great point because we spend so much time focusing on rules that can change and laws that can change to allow these products. These products are now allowed, and maybe we need to focus more on getting the word out that these products are out there, this whole range of products are out there. So that'll be my one of my takeaways from this. Okay.
Thank you. Who's going ahead, Mr. Anderson or okay. Ms. Roan?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, there's also the challenge of selling the products is significant. Most people don't want to save for retirement. And so then, you know, you take that one step further and you say, well, do you want a long-term care policy? And most people say, you know, it's not going to happen to me or I can't afford that right now. I've got two kids in college. I've got a lot of competing expenses. And the product itself can cost between $2,200 and $2,400 a year for an individual. Now, that's for a $5,000 a month benefit for 3 to 4 years, but it can be a costly product. But as I said, there is hope. Hybrid products are one of those bright spots. There are also other products that are currently available that people might not know about. One is called an immediate need annuity, and this is a very new product, but it's actually it provides funding for care for a year or less, and it's a relatively reduced premium, and it's for people that are already sick. So it's one of the, it's possibly the only insurance product that we want you to buy when you're already sick. So that's something that's out there as well. Group long-term care insurance, where the employer is sponsoring the plan, is also another area of growth that we'd like to incent further, and that is an area where tax incentives can help. There's a lot of burdens on employers. But it's one area where we can, where the market has been growing and will continue to grow.
Thank you. Mr. Anderson?
Thank you. Let's skip ahead to slide 14. So I want to make sure we get through all the major points. So this slide is entitled Helping People versus Medicaid Savings. And the key point I want to make here is that when we think about the private market for insurance, it's not necessarily that every dollar spent on private insurance will result in a $1 savings in the Medicaid, you know, coffers. So if you think of the situation where, I guess an extreme example is the first day, you know, like your grandmother breaks a hip or something, falls and breaks her hip. Usually in that situation, you know, there are the medical needs covered by insurance, but as far as the day-to-day caretaking, the family steps in and takes care of those needs. And if there's some sort of either public program or insurance product that addresses those first days of care, usually Medicaid isn't paying for those first days of care. So there might be an insurance product that really helps out a family in that situation, but doesn't necessarily help out the Medicaid situation. So one of my findings was that it's generally the longer-term claims, such as Alzheimer's or, you know, other situations that last, you know, beyond a couple years, where Medicaid tends to kick in after the family is, you know, overly stressed and the savings is depleted. That's when Medicaid really kicks in. And so if the primary, I think there should be two focuses, helping people and focus on the Medicaid situation. But to address the Medicaid situation, it's really some sort of insurance or program that addresses those longer-term claims. And then moving on to the next slide, it kind of gets into this, it talks about the same situation where you know, it's an easy way to kind of differentiate is between Alzheimer's and non-Alzheimer's long-term care needs. So the Alzheimer's needs are kind of recognized by the insurance companies as the reason that there's so much longer claims now. So a dividing line can be considered 4 years, where a typical long-term care need lasts 4 years or less, and a lot of Alzheimer's claims last 4 years or more. And so I don't, currently in the private insurance market, there aren't many products, affordable products, that cover those long 4 year and beyond needs. And so that's where I see, you know, if there's going to be some sort of public program discussed, either at the state or federal level, and an intent is to get an offset with Medicaid savings, that would be an area to focus on, is those Alzheimer's type claims, the long claims. If we're looking for a cost offset, you know, related to Medicaid. I'm just going to fly through some of the slides. One of the things we want to talk about is how government can help. We talked about how we allow combination products now, where you have a life insurance that can be drawn down when there's a long-term care need. And one of the areas that, you know, Rob and I had arguments on, you know, a year or two ago, that we now have a lot more common ground now, is the area of rate increases. So Minnesota's kind of taken the lead to add a lot of transparency in the area of rate increases. And we've recognized this as being a national issue. So we held a public hearing in August of 2015. That was attended by 13 other states because there was so much interest. It kind of triggered a wave of states having public hearings on long-term care, but we were the first one, and there's a lot of national interest. And so one of the key takeaways was that there needs to be a lot more transparency and national collaboration. And so we kind of focused on the Minnesota issue over the past, I think, 13 or 14 months. We granted, I believe, 55 rate increases to companies, where, you know, the prior 13 or 14 months, I think we granted zero. But we were able to, I believe, strike a balance between protecting the interests of the consumers who bought these policies and also preventing financial distress for the insurance companies. And we've had a lot of discussions with the insurance companies, and I personally talked to a lot of very well-educated consumers, and there seems to be respect from all sides and where we ended up. So I think we're trying to promote that nationally to kind of take care of that issue, which I believe will help stabilize the private market and make everything more predictable to allow companies to come back in the market. Maybe Robin can add a word.
Robin?
Yes. You know, the last time I was in front of this committee, I think I spent half my testimony complaining about them on that very issue, because if we don't have some stability, if we don't know when we can get rate increases and when we can't, it's very hard to invest in the product. But Fred really has done an amazing job in setting up objective standards that we can follow and we understand. And so that he's inserted some predictability into the marketplace, it's a big deal. But to the extent that rate increases are going through now, that doesn't, you know, lessen the hardship that they can impose on people who receive them. So there's some things that companies do that I want you guys to be aware of in case you hear about constituents that have issues with rate increases. One of those things is, and first of all, I should mention, Fred mentioned that people don't let go of their long-term care policies. Even when their rate increases, 98% hang on to the policies. So people do not let them go. And part of the reason is because companies work in conjunction with their regulators to help people still hang on. So one of the things that we do is we can work on changing the benefits. So, for example, if you had a policy with 5% inflation protection, but let's say now you're in your 80s, you don't need 5% inflation protection anymore, so we can adjust that so that your premium doesn't go up. Another thing that's available is we call it contingent non-forfeiture because we like confusing names for things, but what it really is a paid-up policy. So if you paid in, let's say you paid in $42,000 in premiums, You would no longer have the ongoing coverage, but you would have a paid-up policy in the amount of $42,000 that you could spend on. So we've worked very hard to make sure that people have options in trying to create this balance between, you know, I think the industry and regulators as a whole feel like we didn't quite get it right the first time, and now we've got it. We believe that we've got it right, and a lot of risk is gone out of the market. And I think there's some very good examples of that. For example, we have a new entrant into the long-term care insurance market. Thrivent Financial, you might have known them as Lutheran Brotherhood, but they're they left the market in 2003, but just came back into it in 2012. They felt, you know, Thrivent is a fraternal, and so they're a not-for-profit insurance company, and they felt the product, offering the product, was important as part of their mission. So they are back in the market. They have 2,770 contracts in Minnesota, new contracts. In 2016, they paid about $27 million in long-term care claims in Minnesota. And they have a very interesting product in that they price it very conservatively because that's what you need to do, but they also offer a dividend on the contract if the cost ends up being less than they priced it for. So that's a way to help share the risk. But also, yeah.
Oh, I was just going to say maybe we want to wrap it up in a couple minutes here, give members a little bit of time to ask questions. So go ahead.
Madam Chair, Mr. Anderson. I think we can consider ourselves wrapped up.
Okay. I didn't mean to stop you.
No, that's okay.
Wow. Okay. Members, do you have any questions of our testifiers? I didn't give them enough time to think. No.
Madam Chair, I would just like to mention areas. Two things we're looking to do, we think they really need to be done at the federal level. But one is we'd like people to be able to use their retirement savings for long-term care without paying a penalty. We think that would be really important. People, you know, that's money they have, and it makes sense to be able to use it for that.
Mm-hmm.
Another is we'd like to be able to have you build up savings in your long-term care insurance policy so we avoid that sort of use it or lose it aspect that is one of the reasons people are uncomfortable purchasing it. So those are two things that we're working on doing at the federal level.
Thank you. I dealt with a aunt, my husband's aunt, who had a great policy, and she was quite sick the last 8 months of her life, but we only used it for 2 weeks. And I thought, wow, I bet she was a little frustrated with that, and we needed it for some things like flying her from Arizona back to Minnesota so we could actually take care of her. But none of her insurance would cover any of those things. So it's nice to see some adaptations to that because, like you said earlier, everybody's situations are a little different, and it makes it hard to invest in that when you are not sure what you're going to need, but I think when we take care of our loved ones, we also realize, gosh, we could be in that situation. Do we want to leave our children? My husband and I actually looked at that when my mother-in-law got sick, and we realized that with our farm, if we wanted it to exist and not be depleted because we may have those problems, we did some planning on that, but there wasn't many options when we did that.
Well, Madam Chair, that is one of the main reasons why people buy is they saw their parents go through it and they don't want to do the same thing mm-hmm. to their children. But there are some new product features that go to exactly what you're saying. So, for example, you can now take, for some policies, you can take 30 to 40% of the monthly benefit as cash. So you can use it to fly your children in town. You can use it to reimburse your children for taking care of you. You know, the companies are trying, now that we have some stability in the market and we understand the risk, are trying to find ways to make the policy more useful to more people.
Well, that sounds like a great idea because I think that would help a lot of families with a burden of wanting to be there but not being able to afford to be there because you're already giving up the job opportunity. You know, you're taking time off from work, and then now you're spending money getting to mom or dad. And, yeah. Members, did anyone have any questions about it? Testifiers? Well, I thank you both for coming, and I'm glad to hear we're working on some solutions, so everybody's happy.
Thank you very
Thank
much.
You.
Thank you. Well, with that, members, we will meet again on February 15th. We only have a couple more meetings before we have to wrap it up. So with that, we are adjourned.